This audio download is the What is Anarchism session from the 2009 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. You'll find more audio online at www.wsm.ie.
Yeah, this is Red Space. This is a talk on what is anarchism. Okay, so anarchism is a broad political philosophy and a practice. And it comes out of humanism and enlightenment ideas in Europe. Probably, but then it also spread worldwide. In fact, there were big movements, for instance, in China. Now, anarchy comes from the word anarchia, and that means anarchia, rulers. So it's an idea of, it's a political philosophy that's radically opposed to the state and rulers. Now, this opposition to rulers and authority is not just a political expression, it's not just opposed to the state. It's opposed to all kinds of political authority, economic authority, and social authority that is not legitimate and accountable. Okay? So, for instance, anarchists would be opposed to sexism, racism, ageism, any form of oppressive hierarchy that doesn't actually take into account, you know, any sort of oppressive hierarchy. Now, anarchists are not opposed to all authority, because that's somewhat ridiculous. There are people who are authorities on various different topics. For instance, if you want to make a bridge, then you know you don't just say, well, anybody can make a bridge. You have to have like civil engineers producing a bridge. But they have legitimate authority, and they're accountable for their actions. And that's what makes the difference. So it's an opposition to oppression and illegitimate and unaccountable authority. Okay, so anarchists, so these are all negative aspects of anarchism. Basically defining what anarchism is in a negative way. It's opposed to authority. But there's also a very positive aspect to anarchism. So in the positive sense, anarchism is about self-emancipation, self-management, having direct control of society, and having a cooperative society. It's about having a mechanism by which people can come together and collectively decide outcomes. And this is actually radically different than what we have now, because right now people actually don't have any sort of collective means of making decisions. All of our decisions are made by rulers, or we can make individual commodity exchange relations. We can make individual choices about our purchasing, but we don't have a way to get together and collectively affect the way that our lives are run and managed. Okay, so as an anarchist, like, there have been many different currents within anarchism, but I'm just going to talk about the more historical one that comes out of the socialist movements of the late 1800s. So here we have these ideas of like worker self-management and community self-management and direct democracy. So people coming into communal councils, workers' councils, and trying to decide how to control their daily lives. Now, this is not... So, anarchists say they're opposed to the state. Now, we have to ask, like, what does it mean when anarchists say they're opposed to the state? Well, the state is an expression of violent control by rulers, okay? So, if you had a self-managed society, a cooperative society, in which people are all making the decisions and actually have control over their daily lives, this isn't actually a state, because it's not a expression of a need to control people. Okay, so like the violent arm of the state, the militaries, etc., are actually organs that the rulers come up with in order to make sure that their hierarchy is maintained. Okay, and so that's how anarchists see the state, view the state. So, in addition to these broad philosophical notions of anarchism, there's also very practical concerns, and anarchism has defined its ideology through struggle and through the attempts at self-emancipation that have happened. Now, one of the primary ideas behind this is that the means must reflect the ends that we want. Okay, so anarchists tend to take direct action, and we see self-emancipation as the route to a cooperative society. So instead of voting for somebody, to delegating authority to a particular figure who's then supposed to act in your stead to control things for you. You actually try to make movements where people come into direct power and direct control. So historically, for instance, some of the demands that anarchists have made in this direct action program are expropriation of the factories, so that, you know, the factories would be controlled by the workers, or communal councils coming into direct power of their cities, etc. These are things, for instance, that happened in Spain in 1936. And in fact, the Bolsheviks stole a lot of anarchist slogans when they saw they were taking off. So, you know, the Soviets actually come out of a lot of anarchist slogans about worker self-management and worker power. Lenin found out that, in fact, he probably wasn't going to be able to control this revolution if he didn't take some of these ideas on board. So, you know, a lot of the expressions of Leninism has actually stolen some of the anarchist ideas and subverted it. So, some other things, like non-reformist reform is also a particular notion that anarchists have. And this is the idea that we can try to have reforms now, but the mechanism by which we should try to approach reform is by coming together and having direct action. So, for instance, when you're in a union and you have a strike, people can come together and decide on doing that. And they're using their own power, their power as workers, in order to force concessions. And that creates a sort of bond, a solidarity, that's about a direct expression of self-emancipation. It's not about delegating authority to somebody else. It's taking things into your own hands. And that is why it's fundamentally different than other mechanisms of reform. So, for instance, voting for somebody who's less bad is not self-emancipatory. You're actually just hoping that they'll do something for you. So it's quite different. So in the end, hopefully, when you get enough solidarity and cooperation, then you hope that you can utilize this to basically make the state unneeded. So, for instance, in Spain, 1936, you had the CNT and the UGT basically made the state irrelevant, and society was largely self-run in various parts of Spain, Madrid and Catalonia. Okay, so really this notion of self-emancipation is both a means and it moves us towards the ends we want, which is a cooperative society, one that's run by us, not by somebody else, and not delegated to some authority. So you can't win by election. We need self-management of our lives, and really we need, in order to do this, in order to have a revolution where you have a cooperative society, you need it to be the most widely accepted notion that in fact we can run our own lives. And without that, you can only have a cadre that or a vanguard. So you could have a revolution with a vanguard, but the problem is that if you have a particular small group of people to take power themselves, then you've just reproduced the problem that people have not gotten together and made a cooperative society. So you just end up regenerating the hierarchical control that you had previously. Yeah. So in order to have an anarchist revolution, you really need it to be the parada. And almost everybody has to start accepting these ideas of self-emancipation. So again, Spain is a good example where you had this broad movement, or the Ukraine, during the white terror in the Ukraine, you also have this broad movement where a large number of people have accepted and taken these ideas on board and actually start running society themselves. So that's anarchism in a nutshell, and it's hoping that you guys would have questions, or you could discuss amongst yourself what you think about it, or if you have any questions you can ask me about what you think about that notion of anarchism.
Just coordination probably is what I mean. Obviously there's going to be conflicts and ideas and so on and so forth, and without being too tyrannical, without forcing, the one kind of danger would be that just somehow by replacing it would become tyrannical in a way. There's I'm just trying to say the coordination of that, how both people are working with it. I mean, how would you say?
Right, so that's a good question. So if you wanted to have a cooperative society with a large number of people, for instance, Europe, on a European scale, you need to have organs in which people can express their ideas. So you need some sort of direct democratic structure. You also need some notion of federalism, because you're not going to be able to communicate, you know, everybody's not going to be able to vote on every single issue that affects them all the time, right? So you probably, well, for instance, the CNT took on the idea of having recallable delegates. So you would have a community structure where people could make direct democratic regulations and policies locally, and then you would have a delegate, and you'd send them to a broader group, right? So you have a federalist structure. Now, if these people don't act in a way that meets the needs of their collective, then they could be recalled and removed immediately. So that's, you know, sort of a half-direct notion. So you do need some kind of, like, coordinated structure for, you know, collective control over things. Absolutely. But would it become tyrannical? I mean, that's, you have to look at, like, trying to make things as horizontal as possible, trying to allow people to remove people in positions of power. So, I mean, you can't get rid of positions of power. Everybody has certain kinds of power in their daily life, right? But you can make people accountable for the power that they wield and make sure that they are actually doing what they're supposed to. And if we, as a broad, you know, group of people, sort of accept and take on board that people are accountable for the power that they wield, then they'll start wielding power in a way that's reflective of that. Yeah.
How many examples do you have, or does anarchy give, of an anarchy, a system of anarchy in place today?
Today?
That has actually stood the test of time. You're expressing one or two instances in Spain for people to govern the management of their own area, whatever else. The closest I can see to the anarchy model that you're expressing is a co-op. I mean, can you give examples? I mean, surely, if people are interested in anarchy, the best way to express an interest is to have a look at a working model.
Right. Okay, so, I mean, cooperatives have a lot of aspects of anarchism within them, but they have to function within a broader framework of capitalism. So, it's actually quite difficult, because you're competing against other organs that are run in a capitalist manner and don't care about how much they exploit the workers, for instance. And so that competition makes it very difficult to exist within capitalist society. The other problem is, to start a co-op, you need a large amount of capital. Okay, so that initial capital expenditure can cause all kinds of... I mean, it makes it more likely that your co-op's going to be small. Okay, so it's not going to be able to deal with fluctuations in the market as much as a capitalist venture would be able to, because they'll be able to outlay huge amounts of capital in the first place. So while they reflect a lot of, like, sort of anarchist-y ideas, it's not likely that you could get a very broad anarchist-style cooperative movement. I'd say right now the most close thing that's currently exists... I mean, there are sort of various small movements in different places. The EZLN, I'd say, is probably the closest thing to an anarchist. The Zapatistas have a lot of sort of anarchistic elements to them. They're not explicitly self-identifying as anarchists, but they do, you know, reflect a lot of that. And that is ongoing and self-managed society. And Spain isn't the only example of where people have broadly taken over the means of production. In fact, in Russia in 1917, that was largely, you know, a working class movement that was taken over by a Bolshevik cadre. And in fact, the oppression of the workers starting in 1918, really, was quite severe by the Bolsheviks. The other example is, like, the Ukraine 1923, these sorts of things. If you look at how those things collapsed, they didn't collapse internally. They collapsed from massive invasions of foreign forces. So, for instance, you know, there's like 13 invading countries in Russia. So the pressures that were going on there were enormous. In Spain, you had, you know, you had El Duce and, you know, the fascist Germany and fascist Italy attacking and bombing and destroying the place, as well as, you know, refused arms to any anarchists or socialists in Spain. So it was really not just crushed from within, it was crushed from without. The Ukraine is also a good example. You have the Poles and Austrians and, you know, these white armies that were funded by various different imperial powers. So in order to deal with that kind of thing, like, revolutionary anarchists believe there has to be a very broad international movement towards this, and it has to be, people have to take on board that, you know, we can actually self-manage, and if we get a broad enough movement in a broad enough locality, there won't be invading imperial forces. So I think that, you know, the idea, there's never been a self-collapse of these sort of anarchistic systems. It's always been an external imposition, I think. That's a very good example, actually, yes. Yeah, the expropriations of factories in Argentina, like, and that's a good example.
That's example I was kind of looking for. I suppose it's just how you refer to anarchy as a movement, seeing as it's like kind of such a broad statement. I mean, it could be three-fifths this movement, three-fifths that movement. It seems to change it depending on the situation.
Sure. I think that's, yeah, that's broadly the case. I mean, these ideas have come up in numerous different places with numerous threads at different times. And, you know, there have been explications, descriptions of anarchism that I think really, you know, give good outlines of, like, what, how the movement should see itself. But I think it's been expressed differently in different places and with, yeah, three-fifths of this and, you know, two-fifths of that. But that's okay. I mean, we should expect a heterogeneity, differences in different places and different expressions. So I don't think that's a bad thing.
How to determine that anarchists should deal with these psychological factors
of selfishness?
Yeah, human selfishness. Because that's one of the things we have to take into account very much, just to avoid becoming a society like a tyrannic society.
The last is the shanty, the Black Panther, I mean, talking about internalized oppression as well. I think a lot of people, I mean, I find, you know, you come to kind of switch like this and it's very open, swandered. You know, if you go back out, I mean, it's more kind of ruling class kind of ideas, and, you know, you're more close in on yourself a lot more. So I think it's a lot of, you know, you need to. Profession that's from inside your own.
Yeah, but apart from that, you also have, as a human being, you also have this kind of feeling where you are, if there's no authority, then you are your own authority, so in a way, right? How would the society sort of control in a good way that collective feeling, so that collectively, you know, the situation is really bad.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I mean, both of those questions are very good. There is a lot of internalized oppression, and there is encouragement of selfishness to maximize that. Now, selfishness is a real human emotion, right? I mean, we want to get what we need out of life, right? So, but these things have been magnified by our exchange relations and the way that capitalism has taught us to behave. So I think we can't get rid of them, but we can turn it so that it's not the biggest factor. And I think the way to do that is through collective action, through solidarity, through learning how to cooperate together. And that's really, it has to be a self-emancipation that we come into collectively to change society. I think that process of learning to find solidarity with other people, learning that you can trust other people to, you know, do things for you and, you know, for themselves at the same time. This idea, the more you see it and the more you do it, the more you come to believe that it's possible. So, and, you know, I think that's really the only way to get beyond that barrier. So we have to try to, that's why, you know, self-emancipation through direct action is really the mechanism by which anarchism can come into actuality.
Yeah,
that requires responsibility.
Yes, there's a huge collective responsibility. There's the individual has responsibility to everyone else, and everyone has a responsibility to the individual. And keeping that connection is, it's something that we have to practice. And practice is the only way to do it. So it's in our practice that we can come to emancipation like that.
I imagine private property has the fact that it exists has a strong influence on the selfish attitude you can see. If it is not possible to get private property, maybe selfish still exists, but it would be a different way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the abolition of private property is absolutely something that we have to be attempting.
But I think there's an idea of selfishness within it, which is that you're saying there's going to be a better society if it's an allied society. So that itself is speaking for self-interest. So if you have examples of anarchist society being a better society, then that will never naturally appeal to people's kind of self-interest.
I think there's quite a lot of literature actually about egalitarian societies and the quality of life in egalitarian societies, but it's not, it's not very popular, and they don't talk about it on the television, and they won't try to sell it to you, you know? So if you look into worker self-management, have a tendency to have better lives at work, when they are actually dictating how work is run themselves, when it's not a boss telling them what to do, when they're actually making their own decisions about their lives. It really does improve things quite a lot, I think, the fact that people are going without food, there's 60,000 empty apartments in Dublin and yet there's still homeless people. These kinds of things, it just would be better, And it would be better for a load of us, But we have to, I don't know, people have to convince themselves by attempting to cooperate, and we also have to try to convince others that it's possible to have a better society. Because right now, I think the biggest mythos out there is that capitalism is the best thing on, and there's no other alternative. And I think, as we go into decline and crisis, I think people are starting to shift their mind about whether or not capitalism really makes any sense at all, but they don't see an alternative. And unless people see an alternative, there's not gonna be an alternative.
I think capitalism kind of one thing it does is it kind of makes people, this is my own theory at least, it makes people think they're happy, because it's kind of, we see this kind of obsession of consumption everywhere, and buying the latest gadgets and expensive food and everything, and it's kind of, we're almost conditioned to want this, and then when we do get it, it's almost like the satisfaction of it's a drug, it's like a drug that makes us happy. And I'm not sure whether we're almost like spiritually, that's the kind of happiness that human beings really want. It's kind of like surface happiness.
Yeah, I'd say that it's not what, the reason that advertisements tend to show you lifestyles rather than products, they try to hint at this is, if you buy this, you can be this person, or you could have a life like this if you buy this product. Obviously, it's people who want something else in that product. It's not the commodity that they're actually trying to purchase, it's something else, And I think that is quite often the case. So you were saying...
Let's say you have a philosophy that's Republican. How does it work in practice, in terms of, say, straight committees, focus committees, and so forth? Is it inevitable that you have a kind of substitutionism? Because, say in Dublin, we have straight committees and focus committees, then you have to, those committees would pass on to a regional committee, say, and then it goes on to a national committee. Is the direct democracy become then a kind of a form of representative democracy?
No, I think there's actually quite a big difference, and that representative democracy, for one, has never been about direct control. It's always you vote once every several years for a particular person, and then they go into that position of power. And they're never somebody who's particularly suited to making decisions on that thing. They're just politicians, right? And they're not recallable, and none of their decisions are can be mandated to come from a direct mandate from the people. So I'd say it's quite a bit different than a republic. Like, electoralism is quite different than direct democracy. Now, having delegates is not the same as having a representative. A representative represents you. A delegate is delegated authority temporarily on your behalf. I think that's a big difference. The fact that you can change, like, for instance, if Cohen decides to bail out a bank or something like that, we can't do anything about it. We actually have no control over the situation. Even if we wanted to, we couldn't change it unless we, actually overthrew the system. There's no internalized mechanism by which we can gain power. He has no accountability. Bertie Ahern has no accountability. I mean, he's getting away with bribes and whatnot, and there's no accountability there. No. So that's the difference. So there's an aspect of what you're saying that's true, but the fact is, if people believed that they had collective cooperative power, they would actually force him to take responsibility for his actions. So it has to do with how people actually see these representative democracies as well. They don't actually believe they have any control. If they did, then, maybe Bertie would be in trouble.
There's two things. First thing is, would not be a very unwieldy system. I mean, if you had to local groups that meet and then you want to make a major national decision or something. And secondly, some kind of centralized power that is there for, let's say, 5 years can at least have a kind of a long-term vision of things, kind of a consistent philosophy which guides the way decisions are made. I mean, sets of, groups of people are coming together every once in a while to make decisions. Won't they contradict each other sometimes, and won't it kind of be chaotic? I don't see how it could always, it could always kind of be consistent with itself.
I mean, there's two tensions there, right? There's a sort of calcification into an unrepresentative bureaucracy, and then there's also, too much, information flow. So these two things are kind of in tension with each other. So, I mean, it's not something that can be resolved at the theoretical level, I'd say. It's something that we have to attempt and get understanding of how these things work. Now, the CNT in Spain, I think, shows both of those aspects. You did have long-term visions. You did have people sitting on planning councils for, periods of time. And you'd want that, right? You'd want people to be experts in what they're doing. But then at the same time, they were also delegates that were accountable. So, people would have to make the decision on whether they trusted them to continue in their activity. It can be done. It has been done before. I mean, we could actually run society ourselves. It probably would take more of us coming together more often in a communal way to make decisions than we do now, because now we almost never do that. So there would be more time doing that. But then we'd lose a lot of leeches, right? I mean, we'd have a lot of people who are sitting, making billions a euro, and we wouldn't have to be funding them. So we probably wouldn't have to work as much, I mean, we just wouldn't have the same lifestyle. I mean, if you think about, 5% of the population owning 50% of capital, that's quite a big amount. So we're sharing the rest of it amongst ourselves, right? The rest of the 19 of us out of 20 are sharing half, and then that one person out of 20 has the other half.
I just wanted to say, what you said, long-term planning. I think the nature of capitalism is directed towards short-term profit. So even if the government is in power for 5 years, all the businesses are looking, how are we going to increase profit in this quarter? However successful they are, they need to increase profit in the next quarter. They need to build the books up. So if you had a community council, say for a town, and they had an oak forest, they wouldn't cut down the entire forest to kind of bring the books back into black, because they'd know our children, our grandchildren won't have this resource. Whereas if you've been a company, they can say, we've bought up all the land, cut it all down, we'll make an immediate profit now, we'll sell it back to, you know, somebody else. And, like, they can, they're trying to make money for making money's sake. Whereas when you have a collective group of people, they're trying to build up their wealth and resources because they own it themselves for their families. So I think capitalism, by its nature, looks for short-term profit without thinking of the long-term consequences. And a real example is the environmental disaster of the world.
Let's say hypothetically we wanted to send them out to the moon. How would an anarchist society do that?
Well,
it's a long-term plan.
You'd have to divert production from other things. So you'd have to get people convinced that it was worth diverting production from other things, like using all those metals and using all those scientists, etc. If you could convince people that that was a good idea, you'd just divert the production to that task. You know, divert labor and divert production to that task. So, I mean, it would be perfectly possible, but people would have to want to do it.
I don't think people would do it. I mean,
should we be going and sending people to the moon?
There's no progress. It's kind of a static society. We find a way without things and we just stay like that forever.
I totally don't see anarchism that way. I think humans are very inquisitive and curious and want to try to figure out how things work and explore.
I don't see these little cooperative people on a local level are all going to come together and decide I'm willing to work an extra hour a day to make resources possible so that we can send something to the moon in 20 years.
Well, I might not be able to see that. It's a totally worthless goal. But, I mean, it's not progressive in any sense, but that's just my opinion. But, I mean, if you had a goal that seemed like it would improve people's lives, I think it would be quite easy to convince people that it was a good thing to do. Yeah, it improves my life. I'd be willing to divert production to
art. I get the same feeling when I look at pictures of outer space. Or I look at a man dancing on the moon that I get from listening to his music. I mean, it's a goal of human beings to go out and learn about the universe, all this kind of thing.
Well, if it's a goal of human beings, then its expression will be doing that. I mean, if it is actually a goal, maybe it's just your goal and you want other people to be... I mean, if you can convince other people it's a good idea, you should be able to get a man on the moon.
I think you have kind of question about what progress actually means. Like maybe technological progress is an obvious one, and for those for anarchist models, we have mobile phones, and of course, some flashiness, and they are with cameras, maybe not. Are those things advanced progress? We've had telephones for 100 years now, like the wires maybe talk to us, other people's sites, other side of the world, with quite basic science and technology. So bringing it to the next level is really that much of a jump.
Well, I mean, the internet is.
Yeah.
In terms of anarchism, what better way for you to express
that? Yeah. And the internet, if you want help in any topic, it's all run in forums, which is almost like an anarchist level because you've got a moderator that just checks no one's cursing on it. But I mean, the amount of support out there, all the support I get from you, everything I learn is from the forums. And some other guy at the computer just telling me what he wants. And I think it's a perfect example of progress online. And of course, when it comes to digital technology progress, like we're not talking about materialism, now at the moment with open source, it's a perfect example of how, for me, that's an anarchist level. It's now open office, it's free, working well. More and more, you see other people's computers using PLC. This is technology that's emerged purely not in the age.
I mean, can I just ask, does everybody here think that space exploration, space is pointless?
Intelligence, or however you term that thing in itself, you know, it's the fact that that's, you know, maybe a subliminal thing. Information is hidden behind the doors of the powerful. You know, that's surely like.
Is that true? I mean, surely you could just go to some book and find out all the information you want to get to know.
That's the case for you.
That you can't understand it because you've never studied.
Because there are some dumb people.
Well, obviously, you can afford books as well. You have the means to get to libraries, and you have the education to access information. You learn how to access education in Sahawai. You have the means to access that information. Mm-hmm. Two-thirds of the world, maybe more, haven't the means to access information. In Sub-Saharan Africa, you can see television, but the only information television releases what capitalism determines to release. That's the difference, and I reject that notion that you can access information. You can't actually access every information you want. You don't have that freedom in that prison. So it's us lucky few of the scale that we have the means to access information. So that's the difference for me.
Yeah, I suppose there's a few things are about and definitely when it comes to progress, I think it's very important that it's prioritized. Like, I don't really see the point of talking about this space exploration or other things until we've actually more global issues started. And then it'll be questioned, is it worth investing this much petroleum into setting up this thing, or is it in the interest of whatever? And that might happen now, might have to wait. Might be a matter of just sitting back and waiting until we have enough energy resource, whatever. But I think it's very important to prioritize things this way. And just on the information point there, I suppose we're kind of led to believe that we've access to so much information now because of the internet. A lot of it's kind of quite dodgy information. Wikipedia is not the best. There is ways of trying to clean it up, whatever. But a lot of like research is about the information that's in scientific journals that cost 30 euro each. And yeah, have to be get you to the universities, but of course you have to go to the universities, and this is where, for me, the Asian sense of common knowledge.
I have a question, if it's okay. I'm more interested in, like, for me, and all opposition on all and all diversity of ideas in any political debate is welcome, but progressive and productive. This discussion generated enough interest in you to come and bring your ideas to all anarchist debate environments and debate it with the rest of some people are feeling close to anarchism, some people are opposing, some people are taking part in anarchism. I'm also interested in the first impact. How does it, is it impacting your ability to participate in the anarchist debate, working class struggle debate as well? I see you're coming from a science perspective.
I'm not a scientist.
But you don't have to be.
So,
is it having an impact on...
This is the first time I've ever...
Yeah.
Actually, the second time.
Yeah. That's what I'm curious about. Is it opening up the doors for you? Yeah, I can come back here and debate my ideas without being pushed out or pushed in. That's what I'm interested in. Just curiosity point as another person.
So you're asking me?
Yeah, I'm just, yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
That's a start, yeah.
I think that that example is pretty graphical in the way of how, in the way of how the purpose, you have to explain the purposes of capitalism in general, right? All we know about the man in the moon thing is that there was a man in the moon, in our moon, with a flag. And the flag was the American flag, right? That's all the information we got. And I think that that's a very interesting thing, you know, because it explains a lot of what the purpose of that trip was in terms of society, right? They might have, you know, some other things, some other interests that were hidden to us, you know? They will never share those things with us. I am working in some sort of research environment myself, and I'm seeing that, well, this is all about, you know, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense for people, right? Lots of people are not interested in their ideas because you are going,
I don't know anyway.
Well,
yeah.
This is a little bit, you know, like mine. And the thing is that what this means to me, at least, maybe, you know, like trying to get straight away to the things. So but these kind of behaviors show me is that what capitalism transmits to people, to us, at last, are concepts as allies, empire, become the best, etc., etc., etc. But the best can be only four of us. We are thousands. So that's indeed, you know, why we do need a change from a perspective.
Yeah, I think it's a question whether people would. I mean, right now there's so many people who don't have access to clean water or, you know, proper sanitation or food or all of these other needs. So when you're diverting production to sending a guy to the moon, in that kind of background, looking around where this is actually true, where there's people starving to death, then that's kind of a bizarre use of resources. And maybe it is edifying in some way, but it seems like, I think that the argument could easily be made that maybe there's other things that should take priority now. But really, I mean, if people were convinced collectively to do it, I think it would become an expression of the collective. So, yeah.
As an example, it's actually a pointless thing to do. It's always painting a picture, or it's always the government giving money to somebody so that they can, so they don't have to work, so they can write a novel. You know, I talk about frivolous novel that people want to enjoy. I mean, you could say that. I mean, this is
I don't think culture is pointless, and I don't think that the collective would deny the expression of culture. I don't think like people coming together would like want there not to be, you know, rock concerts or whatever. I think we would still have them, right? I mean, I would want to go to a rock concert. I can't imagine that that people would tell me that it couldn't happen. I think that would be a weird idea.
But that's just a matter of taste, you know.
Just
you
a
might
of taste.
Like.
Yeah.
I think that it's more important that society we visit and would like to see. It's such a society that all desires and needs are discussed and debated and facilitated, even minority. I like modern art. Pointless, but I have full confidence in the ideology. I'm analyzing, thinking, and trying to practice is that I as a person will be able to bring all my frivolous, useless ideas, creations into it, and have a space of existence for it. And I have also full confidence in human society. It's going to be actually opposite. All these researches and explorations and artistic production that we feel pointless because they don't turn into capital. We'll be expected and facilitated to explore, like street art, street theater, street music, communal art production, least funded, least serviced areas of creative life. So it's a hard one to foresee. I can't, but I have full confidence in the future human society. Our natures are, I think, not destructive, quite opposite. It is productive and progressive.
I think there's one other principle of anarchism that I didn't mention that I think is quite important. It's the idea of subsidiarity. And that's that the smallest body that is competent to make a decision should make a decision. And the people who are involved in the consequences of the decision should be the ones to make the decision. So, for instance, if you have a minority viewpoint that doesn't impinge on the rights of other people, you should have full capacity to make that decision amongst yourselves. So, for instance, what kind of poster I want to put on my wall, that's fine, right? If I want to have, a rock concert in an area that's not going to be too noisy, or, you know, if it was going to be very noisy, you'd have to include the people in the area. But, you know, you could get a decision to do something like that. You don't have to ask everybody, right? Only the people who are affected. And that's, I think that principle of subsidiarity is very important.
Just one element of anarchism, and I'm very new to the idea in reading books, but the idea of a spontaneous leader, that there would be a leader will arise depending on the situation, I just wonder if you had anything to talk about that or how that might work.
Well, I think there's definitely roles in which people can play that would be somewhat like a leader, right? I'm not opposed to the idea of having an authority on a particular thing. Sometimes a particular person should be invested with certain authority. The critical thing is just that they're accountable and that they're legitimate, that in fact they do actually have some special quality that, you know, would allow people to give them, and then they're accountable for their actions. Their power cannot be wielded arbitrarily, but they have to come to account for whatever leadership role they take.
And if the situation where they were to be the leader over our decision making, if that's a situation that's very strange, their leader in that area doesn't transfer from another area.
I don't think anybody should ever be possessed with representative power. So even if you were a leader, I wouldn't say they were legitimate unless they were accountable. And hopefully, it's a question of people believing that broadly to keep that from happening. The only thing that can keep that from happening is people believing that it's,
either morally repugnant or philosophically undesirable to have that situation. Now, people come together in culture. There's quite a lot of culture that we have that dictates the way that we talk to each other, the way that we communicate, the way we live our daily lives. Culture has a huge impact. We see the way that capitalism has had an impact on the way people live their lives. So it is possible for people to have a culture in which they say, oh, actually, that's a bad thing to have a representative, because that's just wrong. You wouldn't do that, you know? It is possible for people to take that on board as a cultural ideal.
Just last thing, what role would you see for like the police industry are not right, just crime prevention, prison systems, basically just keeping society. You know what I mean?
Sure. So currently in our society, we have property rights, okay? So this actually is not a minor issue. If you have a population that's well-fed and well-cared for, you have a lot less crime, vastly less crime. An interesting example is that there's approximately 10 times as many people incarcerated in the U.S. per capita as there are here in Ireland. It has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, it's just ravaged with poverty. There's a lot of poverty there, and people live in really bad, don't have health care, they don't have enough food, there's no safety net, and you end up with a lot of crime. And there's a lot of drug problems as well. That's also a very big factor, and the illegalization problems. But there are people who are psychotic or psychopathic, and that does occur. I mean, people are, you know, uncontrollably violent in certain situations. Now, right now we have a penal system where we punish people, you know, based on transgression of crimes. Being psychotic or psychopathic, to me, is a sort of a clinical psychological problem. And people who are dangerous to everyone around them probably do have to be contained in some way, right? But I'd say it would be more of like a psychiatric problem, you know, than a remedial. Not punitive at all. There's no reason to punish somebody for being psychologically damaged in whatever way, or like psychologically so different that they don't care about you know, the livelihoods of people around them. But I'd say it's a, you know, psychiatric problem rather than a prison problem. And it shouldn't be about punishment. It should be about protecting the rest of society and giving help to people who can get help. Some people can't. Some people are have psychologies that are. I don't think so. I mean, not everything can be remedied. I mean, pragmatically, we're not going to be able to remedy all things. I mean, teenagers are always going to, you know, smash a few windows or whatever when they're, you know, when they're around. There's no way you can get rid of that entirely. I think that we can move in a vastly better direction. And like the distance in the number of incarcerated people between the U.S. and here, I see another step beyond that where we could actually go to having almost nobody in prison, you know? But, and I also think there's no sense in having a revenge system. A penal system isn't necessary. In terms of policing, that's another interesting example of totally illegitimate and unaccountable authorities who can literally kill people without any sort of mechanism for society to, you know, to hold them accountable for those actions. Now, you know, how we would actually, you know, manage that would have to be a decision that we come to collectively about the best way to manage the possibility of violent individuals doing some kind of activity or something like that. I don't know what the best answers to that are, of course, and they will continue to exist. I mean, I don't want to present like a fantasy world, but I think, you know, I think that the space of possible progressive movement is so enormous that, you know, it could be quite a lot different than what we have now.
Just following on from that, just try to work with class abuses at the moment, which is drug addicts. I mean, these people ain't victims. I mean, what do we do? I mean, what would anarchists do in relation to the threat to class communities?
Well,
I mean, we just support certain parents against, you know, I mean, white person myself,
I think we should decriminalize that part of legalize that at the end. Which the anarchist responsibility
to drug gangs. I can't speak to for all anarchists, but I mean, eradicating the capitalism goes a long way to. If you try to make something contraband and make it impossible to get that people really want and keep trying to get, then you're going to end up with a situation in which you have microstates form, where you have individuals with guns trying to move this stuff, this capital around and sell it. So I'd be all for legalization of, like, you know, basically every drug. Probably some drugs may need to be taken in controlled environments or given to people in controlled environments because they do make people dangerous. But I think that that could remove it as a possibility of contraband if you actually allowed people to have it, but only in a controlled, safe environment. In addition, you know, one of the things that people can't get is some way to continue getting money for their lives while at the same time they're in rehab, you know? Rehabilitation is not actually offered as a easy option for people. And I think a lot of people who are addicts don't want to be. And they just don't know how to get out of it. And they aren't given the opportunity. People who want to should be encouraged and given the freedom to get out of these sort of cycles of drug addiction if they feel it's a real problem for them. It's a good question. And they will exist, and they do exist now. It's interesting because in the anarchist community here in Dublin, you see this, that there's certain individuals who actually give a lot of work to, like, for instance, Shomra Spree, very active in helping to build the social center that's there, but don't want to show up to any meetings, or they just want to be told what's on the schedule. And, you know, I mean, that sort of personal autonomy should be allowed. People should be allowed to defer if they want to, but then they should also be allowed to get in on the decision making if they, you know, if they find that in fact their rights are being impinged on. So I mean, it's kind of messy. I'm not sure. There's probably no right answer to it, but I think people's. I mean, you can't force. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, right? I mean, you can't force people to want to be in collective decision making. That's impossible.
Were there any examples from the anarchist movement in Sweden on the lines of police? I was interested in the question that you asked me. You talked about the language. I mean, maybe because none of us know the answer. You know, the state certainly doesn't deal with gun crime and so on. But, you know, how are we dealing with that, you know? Surely it'll have to be community-led solutions or approaches, you know, but are you going to inevitably meet violence or something with violence? You know, that's what I would kind of think, because I don't see any other way around it, you know?
I want to come back to your issue as well. I think about it a lot myself, that, you know, women in general, from the setting I come from, anyway, are usually, you know, women victims of crime is much higher than male victims of crime in the society I grew up. I think it's quite a lot. In almost similar trends of your questions, it's great that you bring up our questions. Anarchism doesn't have a solution or answer unlocked for every human condition and every human issue. But we do offer a way of saying your community. The only suggestion we're making to a community who's going to make decisions on policing drug use is going to be to keep it collective, democratic, participatory. And it is you who are going to answer, your community yourself, who are going to answer to how question. How are we going to do it? It's going to be your solution. As long as it's democratic, anarchist society, and majority should be. And if there isn't a hierarchy of power, this invisible group of anarchists are going to move in, either tell you not what to do or tell you not to do it that way. Then it's not anarchism. In the question of people who opt out in the decision-making process, I agree. them that a certain number of people will opt out of decision making, or will opt out for individual Islamism, or nothing. Or it will be just their personality. They will be shy, or they will be, it's going to be a fair way of living. But I have a lot of faith in human society. Majority of people who opt out of decision making today, they do because they don't feel the power. They don't have the power, and they don't feel the power. That power is taken away from people to have the desire to take part in decision making or push. But they're weeping. There will always be.
I agree that these people today are kind of a product of the sort of kind of study of today. It's the thing, you just sit on your couch, look at TV, and just that, don't participate. And that's the kind of model that makes the few people part. But I think, yeah, some of those people will, but some of the people won't, because it might be human. I think it's kind of a human characteristic.
I also want to go back to, unfortunately, that friend from Galway raised the issue of leadership, spontaneous leadership. Also because I don't agree with Gavin. I mean, quite strong opposition to any form of leadership generated in the society. There are, obviously, as Gavin said, and somebody else, every people with special talents or knowledge of a certain thing that he was in some kind of authority position. A, they shouldn't be permanent. B, they should be transferable. Any power of knowledge, expertise, and talent in human society is transferable. Teacher of
We're laying the groundwork now.
So we shouldn't have a dream like Russian revolution and expect people to internalize the ideology overnight. I've no dreams about that. I've gone through two revolutionary uprisings. I haven't seen people changing overnight. It's not going to happen. So a realistic way of working. But it's no excuse to try to stop the oppression, stop the exploitation. That's we're trying to stop the exploitation of the Jewish. And at the same time, organizing change.
Okay, so I think we've reached the end of the meeting. People can still talk if they want to. Martha Acklesberg is going to be on at 4:30, so I think that'll be a very interesting talk. I think it was very interesting to hear everybody's viewpoints and to have an open forum for it. So I think it maybe is more productive that way than me just spouting off what I think. So.
This audio download is the What is Anarchism session from the 2009 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. You'll find more audio online at www.wsm.ie.